Hi there, it's Brown here with the Capercast number 26. It's the continuation of our passage in Scrimshaw from Cartagena, Colombia, up to Rio Dulce in Guatemala. This one is where we pass through the reefs called Nights of Little Sleep and Keep Your Eyes Open. And as if I could, I will attempt to explain how it is that Joanna and I cooperated on the celestial navigation to the point where we became quite a forged team. Now, please believe that I'm not here to say we ever got any really got good at celestial navigation. We didn't. This was not really an open ocean passage. We did need celestial upon approaching San Andres Island. Our timing was such that we were not going to make San Andres before dark, but we might be able to reach a little key south of there they call East Southeast Key. Oh my gosh, that reminds me of another story I'll have to tell you about it some other time. I had been there at this little key in 1955 or something. So I'm telling you about it anyway. It was in a nifty little 51-foot steel ketch, Dutch-built boat. Anyway, she lost her rudder there at East Southeast Key because the owner decided to show us how he could steer going backwards, and he got going a little too fast. Anyway, blah, blah. Here we were in like maybe 1974, approaching East Southeast Key. It was kind of late in the day, but we had a clear sun, so we were taking sun sights and putting that together with our did reckoning and trying to figure out whether or not we were going to get to East Southeast Key before it got dark. And Joanna predicted yes. And so, I don't know, maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we were staring over the horizon, and sure as heck up came a few palm trees. And Joanna was absolutely thrilled with the results. We were doing this together. I was taking shots at the sun with the sextant, and she was figuring them out. She'd have to go down there and pour through the tables and all that stuff of this little book she had. It's called The Kindergarten of Celestial Navigation, or something like that, you know, Celestial Navigation for Dummies, or whatever it was. She would come up with a line of position, and I could plot it on the chart. No, let's see. I would come up with the observation, that is, the shot at the sun, to record its angle between the horizon and its particular elevation at the time. And the time was important. We had to keep time to the second. And it was, you know, getting into listening to WWV on the radio going bong, 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 clunk, clunking out the seconds. So anyway, we could keep our watch set. We had a stopwatch, and we could get it set accurately. So with that observation of the angle of the sun above the horizon made with the sextant, and with the time kept to the second, and fishing in a bunch of corrections and scribbledy-doo, man, anyway, the sun sight is not too hard to figure out, but she was figuring out sun sights, and she was delighted to predict that we were going to arrive at East Southeast Key before dark, which in those waters was very important because there's reefs all over the place. So anyway, I've got a great photograph of Joanna sitting on the after hatch in a bikini with a glass of wine and our Borkum Riff pipe, feeling very smug about having been able to reduce this sun sight down and predict that we were going to see those palm trees right about now. She was tickled with that. But in a couple of years of coastal sailing, that's about all the real celestial we had done. So that's the backdrop for the story of when we left that night at 11 o'clock from Old Providence Island, headed up through the reefs. We were doing it at night because the winds were not so strong, and the boat was quite close-hauled, not totally strapped in, but doing our best, really, to sail full and by on this course in order to take us up to the point where we might, in the morning, sight these two little landmarks, Bobel Key and Cock Rock. Well, after sailing in the dark for several hours, after a wholesome meal and a little rest, the boys were sacked out because Joanna and I didn't quite trust them to really hold the course. It was terribly important that we stay on the course line. And I can't remember what time it was, 2 or 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, something like. I'd been steering for a while, and Joanna took over so I could go down and get some rest. And I was trying to get some rest down there when I realized I was putting my family in a rather precarious predicament here. I didn't feel too good about this because I wasn't really sure that question that Bull had asked me. Captain Bull said, "How much leeway are you making, remember?" And we had our big, deep centerboard full down, and we figured we were not sliding off the leeward very much, but I didn't know how much, and I was really worried about staying on the course line and not getting swept to port. So we were crabbing up a little to starboard, and I didn't know whether we were crabbing too far to starboard, and I told Joanna she really had to keep her eyes open because this was the night of little sleep. And I was down there in the stern castle really trying to get some rest, unable to sleep because of this predicament I had put us in. And there was a fair bit of angst in it. And the next thing I knew, Joanna had slid the hatch open. She was up in the cockpit, and she slid the hatch open, and she said, "Hey, Jim, get your sextant. I can see Venus up here." Well, when I'd gone to bed, we couldn't see anything. The sky was totally overcast. But by the time I got suited up and up there with the sextant, I could see that there were holes in the overcast. And sure as heck, now and then you could see a little bit of sky in places, you know. And she said, "No, hang on, you'll see it. Just watch right up there. It's dead abeam of our course. If we can get a line of position, an LOP off of that star right now, it'll tell us whether or not we're left or right of the course line." Ah, man, okay, now's the time. But I said, "Hey, babe, that's a planet, you know. It ain't easy to work planet sights. They vary all over the place." And she said, "No, I was reading ahead in the book, and if you can get a good sight on that thing, I'll work it out." So here we are in this little boat stomping along the windward against the Caribbean trades. And the boat is heaving up and down over these crests, you know, every 5 or 6 seconds. There's, a real mogul to climb. And it turns out that the time to take sextant sights is when the boat is on the top of one of the largest local waves. It's that business of being able to see the horizon. You really got to see the true horizon, not the top of the nearest crest, in order to get an accurate observation of the angle between the horizon and the celestial body you've got the sextant focused on. And once about every 20 or 30 seconds, the boat would fall in a hole and it'd be a big slam and spray flying all over the place. And I'd have to duck and stick the sextant into the opening of my foul weather jacket, try to keep spray off of the lenses. Little by little, I realized if we really gave it a chance, we were going to get a shot at Venus. Okay, it was a very bright star up there, obviously a planet, and we'd been watching it in previous nights. That had to be Venus, but we had never tried to work a planet sight before. So before I came up, I set the stopwatch, you know, I let WWV go to boing, boing, boing to the nearest minute, and I punched the button on the stopwatch and wrote down what the actual time was, the Greenwich Mean Time, Coordinated Universal Time, as they say on the radio. So she had the stopwatch, and I had the sextant, and I got the thing kind of zoomed in. You know, you have to squeeze and then wind the bottom end of the arc of the instrument so that in this split lens image that you get, you can see both the horizon and the celestial body at the same time. And the important thing to do is to swing the arm of the sextant so that you actually bring the celestial body down to the horizon at exactly the right time, the time when the boat is being booted in the ass going over the top of one of the largest local waves. And of course, there's a lot of roly-poly going on. I often thought that this was, you know, really much more demanding than pistol shooting. because you could see that the way to do it was to just to rock the sextant slightly, incline it slightly, right or left, in order to cause Venus to swing down and kiss the horizon just as the boat went over the biggest wave, and you would holler, "Mark!" I'd holler, "Mark!" to Joanna. She'd punch the stopwatch, read the stopwatch, write down the number of seconds since I had taken time to the second off of the radio. And then, holding the flashlight in my teeth or even ducking down below in order to read the vernier on the sextant, to actually read the degrees, minutes, and seconds of that observation of that celestial body at that second. And then we'd write down what the sextant said together with what the watch said. Now, of course, it helped if the boat was held on a steady course in the meantime. So there's Joanna, hanging onto the stopwatch, watching the compass on the tiller, while I'm trying to wait for the boat to go over the largest of the local waves and holler, "Mark!" And it's so many seconds, and she writes it down. And, of course, she's trying to write it on a piece of wet paper on a wet cushion in the cockpit, using perhaps the illumination coming out of the compass in order to see what she's writing and to see the watch for the next shot. I took several, and the idea was for me to try to get an empirical feeling for which of them was the best shot. I think we took 4 or 5 shots at Venus that night, and there was one of them that I felt pretty good about, and I said, "Okay, it's that one. Maybe let's say it was number 4. And with that information, I took over the helm, and she went down below, turned up the lamp in the stern castle. We had kerosene light on board in those days. We had an Aladdin lamp in the stern castle. And you could get good illumination on your notepad. But here she is down there with the boat bounding up and down. Like, I mean, it's really, I think you travel almost as far vertically up and down as you do forward in conditions like that. But she was down there figuring away, and we were yakking back and forth, and she said it looked like all of the observations that I had made were right tight in a group. None of them were really bad, but she took number 4, let's say, and worked out the so-called LOP, line of position. It's just a few freaking numbers, and I'm not going to get into telling you how it works, but anyway, after she had the line of position, she asked me to come down and plot it on the chart. She came up and took the helm, and I went down there and, you know, turned the lamp up again and really got down there and looked at the latitude and longitude tabs along the side of the chart and really scrutinized it 2 or 3 times, making sure that I was moving from the right degree in the right direction, and finally came up with a plot. That is, I was able to lay down a line on the chart that represented a point on the face of the earth, and it was anywhere on this line on the face of the earth, which really described a giant arc, but we think of it as a straight line in theory, a line of position, because we're going to take just a short piece of that line out of this giant curve and say, okay, we are somewhere along that line. We only had one sight. But because Venus was dead abeam of us, poking through the clouds now and then, dead abeam of us, we were able to get an LOP that told us if we were right or left of course. And I laid that line down there on that chart and drew it with a pencil, and it plunked right in on top of the line that Captain John Bull had put on there that morning. Man, I felt good about that. That gave us some indication that at least we weren't too far left or right. How far were we from up the course line or not up the course line far enough? Were we going really 4.5 knots? We were doing our best. Anyway, it went along like that, with Joanna and I cooperating over the navigation, pushing and shoving numbers for an hour or two. And finally we decided we were okay, and there was beginning to be the very slightest light in the sky to the east. I don't know, maybe it was 5:30 or 6 o'clock, what they call a false dawn, but it seemed to have a little something screwy about it. It was actually lighter overhead than it was in the east. The lighter it got, Of course, we realized that here was down on the horizon this enormous bank of cloud that was just bearing down. We watched this thing come. It was the damnedest tropical squall I think I've ever seen. It was literally boiling. The front of the cloud line was, you know, look. By now the boys were up to see what the heck was going on. And as 7 o'clock approached, so did the squall line. It always adds up on you like that. Like the man said, it seems like it's out to get you. Well, we got ready. We reefed the mainsail way down, put up a little staysail, and got the hatch boards in. Everybody suited up. It's hot stuff, you know. Sailing gets to be like that sometimes. You're definitely faced with a serious urgency. And we were all doing our best to look off to the horizon when we thought we might be able to see Cock Rock or Bobel Key, but just before the time when it was 7 o'clock when we should have been able to maybe see it, oh man, this weather set in. It was terrific. All the way from the north to the south, it was being just lit up by almost continuous lightning flashes within it. And, of course, the closer it got, the louder the thunder. Then it started to rain, even though the gusts hadn't come yet. And there's that old sailor's saw that applies in the tropics. It says, wind before the rain, you can let your topsails remain. But rain before the wind, you better get your topsails in. It blew enough in gusts to make the rigging scream, you know, but it also blew enough to flatten out the sea. The rain and wind really flattened out the sea, and it got to be, 7:10, 7:15. We couldn't see a thing, nothing. But if we looked down, we could see that the water had turned swimming pool green. Of course, that means shallows over sand. Well, the time was right, and the wind was so hard that we couldn't keep going the way we were going anyway, so we got the sails down and turned off and went under bare poles, loping along while Stephen was down in the cabin calling out soundings from our silly little rotational bulb sounder, and Russell was up on the bow ready with the anchor, and we got blown in over what could have been a crashing reef. Stephen was calling out soundings, and, oh, hey, Dad, it's getting shallower. 14 feet, 12, 13, 12, 10, 12, 10, 9 feet, Dad, we're down to 9 feet. We were looking at the bottom. It was raining so hard that the water, the droplets would hit the surface and drag an air bubble in with them so that the whole surface of the sea was actually effervescing like champagne, rather, and it was swimming pool green. But we had no idea what we were heading for. I thought maybe if we were to come on the reef with this wind and these waves, we could probably get blown over it. We could get behind it at least. We might be have our bottoms ripped out, but we could drop the anchor and at least we'd be safe. But pretty soon, Stephen started calling, "Hey, Dad, it's getting deeper. 16 feet, Dad. Hey, 16 feet, 18, 15, 18. Hey, Dad." The variations are caused by the boat bounding up and down over the waves, you know. Pretty soon it was clear that we were back into deep water, that beautiful, dark, almost cobalt Caribbean blue. We will never know whether we went through that reef in the right place. But let's hear it for John Bull. I think we were probably pretty close. And from there, we were able to set a course, a fair course, fair wind, for Cabo Gracias a Dios, and sail very wide around it to make sure, past the Honduras Bay Islands, and went down into there, what I call the crotch of the Caribbean, between where Honduras, the north coast of Honduras, runs east and west, and then, of course, the east coast of Belize and a little bit of Guatemala runs north and south, and right down in there in the corner between those two hunks of coast is the entrance to the Great Sweet River. And boy, we sailed into that gorge. We were so glad to get there, get out of the ocean. It was flat calm, and then went on up through this gorge. It's about a 4 mile gorge where the limestone cliffs on both sides rise up in places as high as 500 feet. But in other places, it's all well-rounded, but there's a lot of bare limestone rock with jungle, just huge tangles of jungle hanging down the rocks, trees growing out of the bank over the river, horizontally out over the river, and everything this incredible green. Well, it was getting late, so we pulled over to the north side of the gorge and grabbed a bunch of vines and just tied onto them and spent the night right there in the gorge. And when I just first started to move around in the morning, all of a sudden we were greeted with this enormous ruckus in the trees just above us. It sounded like a whole kennel full of German shepherds barking at us. It turned out to be howler monkeys. They can make the most deafening noise, especially when you're up close to them. We had apparently invaded their territory, and they had climbed over to see who and what we were. And when we started moving, their tactic is noise to drive away problems. Well, they drove us away, okay. Now, we had seen the gorge before by motorboat when we had visited the Rio Dulce when the boat was on the Pacific side of Guatemala, so we knew what we were in for, but I thought it would have been a really wonderful experience to enter Guatemala by the Rio Dulce not having been there before. Well, after a few tight twists and turns in the canyon through this gorge, we came out into what they call Golfete. It's a long, slim lake with a few islands in the lake. We stopped at Catamaran Island Hotel. Honest to God, that was the name of it. Very bushy bungalow hotel on this little island with Tarzan jungle all around. No roads, no running water, no electricity. They got this little bungalow hotel with its own generator and propane. The rooms were former United Fruit Company crew shacks. And we already knew the people that ran the place, and so we stayed for a couple of days and made arrangements to rent our own little United Fruit Company crew shack not far down the river. And it was really a cool spread, man. It was elevated up on a high bank with a little tile walkway that came down to a great palapa, you know, a thatched shed close to the water with the barbecue and hammocks and stuff. And then a little more walk out onto our own dock when we tied our own boat up and we stayed for 8 months. Yes, indeed, we had found our own certain sanctuary that certainly must exist somewhere for all of us. And getting there had really made us into quite a family team, especially when it came to the celestial navigation. Of course, nowadays everyone uses GPS, and including ourselves when it came available in the 90s. It's so easy and so accurate that nobody has to worry about being lost anymore. So long as the thing is working, I mean, we would have known for sure that we were on the course line that night of little sleep. But we would not have had the experience of working with, indeed, working through the essential urgency of celestial navigation in tight waters. I think it was that challenge, together with many others, of course, that brought Joanna and I very close to being not just man and wife and mom and dad, but captain and mate. With Steve and Russell on board, we had our own deck apes. And many years later, when Joanna and I were still sailing in Scrimshaw, but by ourselves, without the boys, we really missed them. They had gone off to become their own navigators in their teens. And I think that would have left Joanna and I staring at each other and saying, "Is that all there is to the circus?" Unless we hadn't still had the boat. Now, I'm sure there are many cruising families that have had the same sort of consolidating experience. One such couple that I've gotten to know recently is Mort and Fran Van Howe. I asked Fran if she would be willing to write something up for me that explained what their relationship with their boat had meant to them in their lives. She did that. She's written me a letter, and I can't get Christy to read it to us. I think she's jealous. So I've asked Joanna to read it for us. This may be the first and only time in all of the podcast history that you'll hear from Joanna. So here she is, Shakespeare's Dark Lady, with the words of Fran Van Howe.
What sailing means to us. Even before we were married, when we were just in our 20s, Mort and I were lucky enough to be invited on a cruise to northern Lake Michigan and its islands aboard Gracious, an 8-meter sloop owned by a pair of friends, an older gentleman and lifelong sailor from the East Coast, and a fellow our age. We were hooked on the feeling of adventure and relaxation that came over us during that week sailing on the boat, despite a storm, engine fire, and wet bunks. The cruise on that beautiful 48-foot classic sailboat was a highlight of our lives. We have owned our own classic sloops since then, a Pearson Vanguard and a Pearson Invicta, along with a variety of smaller boats. We cruised on the Great Lakes and Canada ourselves in the summers. Later on, when we had time, we figured out how to get away from our home in Saugatuck, Michigan, go down the river system to the Gulf of Mexico, and on to the Bahamas on Meteor, our Pearson Invicta. Through a lot of hard work, Mort's mechanical abilities and ingenuity, and a shared goal, in 2000 we started sailing for 6 months in the Bahamas every winter. And what a learning curve it was. The saline after the Sweetwater Sea, with all its tides, currents, underwater life, and depth changes, was challenging and interesting. The information and lessons and familiarity with the ocean became a beautiful and fascinating passion, with lots of mistakes along the way. We had some fabulous mentors along the way. And one day, in 2005, in a distant and remote anchorage in the crooked Acklin Islands, we met some cruisers on a multi-hull who gave us a book called The Case for the Cruising Trimaran by Jim Brown. We both read the book with interest. Some weeks later, in the anchorage near Staniel Cay, Bahamas, we happened to anchor near two Sea Runner trimarans, a 40-foot and a 34-foot. The 34-foot Essence was for sale. We decided to buy her and keep her in Florida as our winter cruising boat and leave our Invicta in Michigan. Our new boat, christened Alato, needed some serious love, and we poured it on, restoring, improving, and protecting this beautifully built trimaran. The builder had crafted her over a 5-year period, and she had great bones. Here we were with the ideal island boat, fast, shallow draft, and with our care and upgrades, she is reliable, comfortable, and a platform for many more years of exploration. What drew us to this life? With a compatible partner, you can share adventure and excitement, meeting and enjoying people from around the world, being out there in nature for unforgettable moments of contact with dolphins, whales, sharks, birds, fish, and fascinating small mysterious beauties of life beneath the surface of the sea. What an amazing payoff for working hard, moving forward into the unknown, and deciding to go cruising. Our boats are homes for years of time. We knew their every sound and sigh, the movements and signals that something was amiss, or that all was perfect. Each day is bright with possibility, with peacefulness. You live mostly outside, with shelter on your back, and you can move about or stay put as the winds allow. Tuned in and turned on. Need I say more?
Hey, thank you, Joanna. And no, Fran, that about says it all for you and for me. Bye-bye.